Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome everybody to the second episode of our live show on the True Crime Gangland Wire True Crime Stories. Can't get my head back into this. We're going to talk about Nick Civella and politicians, starting off with today. My friend Aaron Gunnerk is here. Hi, Aaron.
Hello, Gary. Thank you for having me. Thank you for doing this. It was actually me that suggested that we do this as a live podcast recording because we have such a good time in the studio talking about this. I thought that there would be nothing better than bringing it out for people in the public to share the experience.
So it has been fun.
Thank you, and thank Terrence, and thank all of you for being here tonight.
Thanks. And our friend is Terrence O'Malley. I've lost it. I can't seem to get it back together. Wasn't he great? He was great. He was on here. We had him on here doing the Union Station. You want to look that up, go to iTunes and subscribe to my podcast and look up the Union Station Massacre, episode 1 and 2. It was really great. So anyhow, let's get started here talking about Nick Civella and the politicians. And you see Nick up there? You know, he kind of looks like Junior Soprano. If you guys ever watch The Sopranos, always uncanny resemblance to Junior Soprano. Yeah, Nick, I'm sorry, buddy. Anyhow, let's play a little clip here. I'm going to talk about how he first started getting involved in politics.
The video corruption clip?
Owsley Teamsters.
Okay.
This is retired FBI agent Bill Owsley.
He really acquainted with Nick at a ad hoc political committee that he sat on, with Nick representing, of all things, the political entity of the North End. The mayor of Independence, Sermon, was a member. Williams was a member, and some others. And the idea behind it was that this ad hoc committee would review all of the candidates, select one that they thought was the best, and try to get all of the divergent political factions together, rather than fighting each other. And this committee was the one that picked that person and recommended him. So here's Nick sitting next to Roy Williams on the committee, just like the fox sitting next to the chicken, who he's eventually going to eat him. So the relationship began.
Okay, so that's how Nick Civella first met Roy Lee Williams, who was an important Teamster and would go on to be the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. And you know, to have that connection to the Teamsters Union is gold. It's just gold for a mob guy, because this is in the early 50s, and even then he was able to sit on this Democratic nominating committee. But it was really hard. It was getting harder and harder for mob guys to have much direct effect on elections, and the old strong arm tactics weren't working anymore.
No.
They didn't own the prosecutor's office, and the feds had come in and were starting to really look at these things by this time. They still denied, Herbert Hoover still denied there was a mafia, but they would look at these kinds of things as a professional criminal and influence in elections. And so they could not operate near as high, wide, and handsome as they had. Now, when you've got the Teamsters, you've got a ton of money. And so you can then go to a politician, a Jackson County legislature, or you can get a judge and help that judge get elected with Teamsters money, because anybody would take Teamsters money in an election. And this would continue on. This was the way on up into the modern times that the mafia continued, the La Cosa Nostra mafia continued to influence elections and have influence over politicians, to get people placed on probation and parole boards in the 50s and 60s, and those things like that. We had a judge, and when I came on the police department in 1971, named Louis Mazzucci, and I happened to find, I heard a couple, three stories about how he had let people go for funny reasons, and I found an old picture in a newspaper where on the front row is of a political meeting of the Negro Women's Voters Association. Was John Lazy, and he was going to address them. Yeah. And sitting on that front row was Louis Mazzucci as a young man. And Gaetano Lococo, or Tano Lococo, who was one of the what we call the Five Iron Men, or the Sugar Shack Gang, who controlled all the bootlegging in Kansas City, he was sitting right next to him, too. And there was a couple others, and I can't remember.
Charlie Gargano was there
yeah. too. Yeah. And so this man was still a judge in 1971, 72, until he finally died. And I don't remember when Judge Mazzucci died. So, you know, that those tentacles extended on past out of the 30s and 40s into the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s and on a reduced basis. But that's really where it started, and the Teamsters were really politically powerful.
Well, I was going to say, wasn't the Teamsters themselves also, I mean, they had a lot of money from the organization itself, but also they had a lot of members. And so they delivered a lot of actually legitimate votes for whoever they were. In this case, if it was Gargatta, or if it wasn't Lazia anymore, because he had been killed.
Right.
Gargatta took over for him. Gargatta was killed, and now it was Nick Civella.
Right. He was a titular head. This is his brother, Corky Civella, who was kind of his consigliere co-boss, shall we say. Wouldn't you say he was?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Cork Civella was no saint. He was the prime suspect in the murder of a Commerce Bank carrier I believe it was 1936. They executed this guy carrying a bag of money who was moving it from one Commerce Bank location to another, and actually had a bodyguard with him. And they hopped out of a car and they shot the guy a bunch of times in the head and then made off with the money. And so they really think they say Cork did that. And Cork was also arrested for morphine distribution in the 1930s. Kansas City.
So goes the myth of the mafia not involved in drugs.
Not involved in drugs, right. And then what I heard about, and I'm sure, you know, Gary, you know the story really well, that basically when Nick Civella went to exercise his control over Roy Williams, he basically kidnapped him.
Right.
And took him to a remote location. And what they used to do is they'd set him in a chair and they'd shine a bright light on him. And the way Bill Owsley tells the story is that basically Nick Civella ticked off the names of Roy Williams' wife and his children. And he said that he was threatened that if you do not do what I, Nick Civella, tell you to do moving forward, we will kill your family members, and then we will kill you. But we will kill them first. And so basically from
that. And they got that. Roy Williams in later life ended up testifying against mob people and other Teamsters. And so they got that story direct from the horse's mouth. That wasn't just some, from some third party informant. That would have been directly from him. And fast forward to the 70s, why they did the same thing with a man named Alan Glick, who was a casino owner out in Las Vegas, owned the Stardust Casino. And those of you who have seen the movie Casino, it was the Lefty Rosenthal. Robert De Niro character,
yeah.
And I don't remember who played Alan Glick, but there was another man who actually owned the casino. Lefty did not own the casino, or Ace Rothstein did not own the casino, and there was another man that owned the casino, but that man that owned that actually had the money invested in it. They called him back to Kansas City to jump on him about some things they didn't like, and they took him to a hotel room up by the airport, and Nick did exactly the same thing. He put the a light in his eyes, just like the old third degree out of the cop movies in the 50s and 40s, and threatened his family
Right off the names of his children and birthdays.
Actually, he didn't do that. You know who did that?
Tuffy DeLuna.
Tuffy DeLuna did that exact same thing. And Alan Glick testified to this. Alan Glick then goes back to Las Vegas, and they still, now they want him to sell out the casino because he's still not doing what they want. So they just tell him, you got to sell out. So Tuffy DeLuna calls him in, and Glick testifies that Tuffy picked up a piece of paper and read off the name of my wife and my children.
And, yeah, it's and two said, sons, I
we'll,
think.
We'll kill them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's Bad business. So I'm going to tell you a quick story here about in 1959. This is in Bill Owsley's book, The Mobsters in Our Midst. There was a 25th wedding anniversary of Nick and Catherine Savella, and it was at Eddie Odishay's, or how did you pronounce
Osatchi.
That? Osatchi's.
Yeah.
Probably more correct pronunciation. Well, I've got the hillbilly pronunciation. he ran Mirror Lake Country Club, which is up on 45 Highway. It's where the National is now, if you know where the National Golf Course and the Deuce. I think it's where the Deuce is now. I play that all the time at National, too. But
nice to be retired.
It is.
You don't find any bodies up there, though, do you?
No, I don't. But in attendance at this 25th anniversary party, because the sheriff, I think Arvid Owsley, actually sent some people up there, and they wrote down license numbers. In attendance were a city council member named Tom Gavin and another city council member. Maybe you've heard this one. You remember it, Sal Capra. State Senator Jasper Brancato. There was a Democratic Party leader who was kind of like a behind-the-scenes guy, never really ran for office, named Alex Presta, but he backed a lot of politicians, and he was up there. There was a Democratic ward boss named Henry McKissick was up there. There was a Jackson County judge named Hunter Phillips, and the president of the Board of Police Commissioners in 1959, a man named Lyman Field, was up there. And he was quoted in the paper about a year later saying there's no organized crime here in Kansas City.
Now, wait a minute. Lyman Field, right. Is he an attorney?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's Field Gentry Benjamin.
Right.
That's
right.
Harry Truman's law firm.
Interesting.
Well, no wonder there's no mob in Kansas City.
Yeah.
They have the attorneys to back that up. Well, so all of these people show up at this anniversary party that's clearly... one of the top leaders in Kansas City of organized crime.
Sure. All the top people in organized crime would be there, and then all these politicians. So it hadn't stopped.
No. Well, and then I think one of the most evident things of the corruptive influence of the Teamsters in Kansas City was the execution of Floyd Hayes in 1961. I mean, I don't know if you all know this, but Roy Williams, who of course would go on to become the president of the Teamsters, he was facing an embezzlement charge in 1961. And this guy who was a union officer representative named Floyd Hayes was going to testify against Roy Williams. Well, Nick Savella couldn't have the golden goose get killed. And so at King Louis Bowling Alley at, I think, 77th and Troost,
right.
Floyd Hayes was getting out of his car, getting in. he was right by his car, and another car swung around and basically shotgunned him to death.
Gary, is that in your app for that particular location?
That is not in my app.
You might want to add that to your...
I should add that. I've got that story.
App.
Yeah, and I mean, he was really, really blown away. It's one of the most gruesome morgue pictures I've ever seen, really, frankly. But so guess what? The case against Roy Williams went away real fast. There was no case against Roy Williams. He got away with the embezzlement charge, and then he continued his ascendancy up through the national ranks of the Teamsters.
Okay. Do you know the story about the fire department, the union, when they tried to unionize the fire department? I'm trying to remember that. I better not go down that route. There's a particularly interesting story, a little more in the modern times, and because it is World Series time, let me get my paper here. I can't remember all these details like Terrence can.
We had that one clip that we had, the political corruption clip?
Let me tell this story and
okay.
Then we'll play that. And so Harry Wiggins, who was a state representative, longtime state representative, good friend of the police department, he always would sponsor Kansas City Police Pension Fund and Kansas City Police legislation for us. And he had season tickets to the World Series, and he had opportunities to get more tickets in the 1980 World Series. Back then, they weren't so popular. And
they weren't so expensive.
They weren't so expensive. And he had several extra tickets. And Sal Capra called him up and said, you know, I have an old decrepit friend who just would like to go to one World Series before he died. Could you help me out and get a couple of tickets?
Yeah.
And Harry Wiggins said, you know, Sal, I'd love to help you out, and I'll do that. So he got him, gave him these two tickets, and so he goes to the game, and Wiggins is there. So Wiggins is kind of a glad-hander and wants, likes to meet people, and he probably wanted a little credit for giving out those tickets. So he drops by those seats. And he gets up close and he looks and he sees that who that old decrepit friend was.
Nick Civella
and his bodyguard Pete Tamborello,
who just died here recently.
The last man standing. Pete Tamborello was Nick's driver for years, and he was the last of the old guard out of the 60s and 70s to go, and all the rest of them are dead.
Do you think Pete's buried in that same cemetery?
I don't think so. You know, I didn't really track on that one very well when he died and what happened.
There's a famous clip of Nick exiting Royal Stadium from the 1980 World Series.
Oh,
yeah, because the news photographers heard that there's Nick Civella sitting there watching the World Series.
Well, what happened? Here's what happened.
Yeah.
Is Harry Wiggins knew that he was in a trick bag, what we call in the police department a trick bag. You know what that is, Aaron?
No, what's
Aaron
a trick
is
bag?
Always going, you know, what does that mean? Well, that's police slang for, you know, you are in trouble and it's not of your own doing and it's hard to get out of it. That's what we call a trick bag.
So the mobs would get these guys where they were.
So Harry Wiggins in a trick bag, because what if somebody else sees that and then they say, well, where'd Nick Civella get those tickets? And then they go to the Royals and they say, well, who has seat number, you know, row CC and CC?
Harry owns them.
Well, that Harry Wiggins had those. Well, I'll be darned, you know, talk about a big expose. He's in a world of hurt. So he was a pretty canny guy. Here's what Harry Wiggins did. He calls the newspaper himself and says, here's the deal. Send somebody out. So they immediately send somebody out who then confronts Nick Civella, who they also call the TV stations, and they send out a camera crew.
Yeah.
And they confront Nick Civella down there, and then at first he says, well, I got these from Harry Wiggins, and of course they already know that he didn't, and they actually already know where he got them from, but he lied to them right there, and they got him on tape lying about that.
So
they wrote a nice little article, and
he was pretty confrontational about that.
Yeah, he was real confrontational.
Well, Nick was dying of cancer at this point too, right?
1980, he was.
They had actually let him out of prison at that point. He had been in, and they had let him back out.
Well, I think he needed to go back in again before they let him back out.
He did go back in again right after that, but he had...
They let him out for the World Series.
He let him out for the World Series. So that's, I mean, you know, that's kind of how it works, is they get their hooks in a guy, and they keep them, and then they use them. And I've got an interesting little clip. It's a wiretap from, and I wish we could do...
Show it on video.
I wish we could show it on video, but we can't. So listen to the audio.
You play the video.
Oh, okay. Let me...
Ready? In
three. I don't know. I don't think I... Oh, I know. I've got to go to the... Bear with us, folks. We have technical difficulties. I've got to...
If you pull up the file, I've got it here, the audio. I've got it queued. I've got the video, but...
And this is going to be audio that actually was surveillance audio.
This audio will be from the 1976, 77, 78 wiretaps in which we uncovered the skimming from Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah. Gary, why don't you tell the story about how you guys did that, huh?
how you put the bugs in there. That's in the back of
yeah.
the...
That's a long story.
Oh, the trial.
I've got a whole movie on that called Gangland Wire.
We got plenty of time.
Okay, you got it going.
Come in, people.
It's going.
Just a moment.
You guys here?
Yeah.
It's important right now that two fellas that I'm playing with, one's a commissioner, one's a judge, and anybody to play ball with them.
Okay.
Yeah. You know. And... I'm doing all these things, Mr. S, you know, for myself. I'm trying to build my own base. I mean, you know better than anybody else.
Keep going.
But I hear a lot of conversations, and I just listen to, you know.
In Quinn and Peeble's conference room, Nick tells Tuffy about a conversation with Carl Thomas about the new sheriff.
He said that the new guy
right individual contribution of anybody. And if the matter relates, he has 16 to cater his victory party. He didn't know where to go or how to handle it. He didn't know how to arrange one hotel, so CT arranged a victory party for about 300 people and had it catered. And it cost him like maybe $3,500. I said, he asked you to do that. He said, yeah. So would you appreciate it? He said, it sure seemed like.
Carl Thomas was the biggest shocker to a lot of people in Las Vegas, among those who were involved in the casino business, because he'd been seen as the new generation. And then it comes out, gee, he isn't clean. And it's kind of a reminder of how naive we all can be about the connections that people have.
Nick explains how to handle a corrupt politician.
But also don't abuse him, you know, don't misuse him, don't play a little shit deal in it. And if the word gets out that you know the guy, and every little turd comes to you, you deny it. You say, look, I can't go to that. In other words, say it in for important matters. You say, you're up on the head of you, but they can just say, hey.
All right. So that's how you deal with a corrupt politician.
You don't go to them for every little thing?
Ever don't go to them for every little shit and deal that comes up.
You cater their victory party.
and you know what's interesting about that is that victory party. See, they never know. There was arguments on these wiretaps about whether Carl Thomas was really giving this money to these politicians because they thought he might have just been stealing it from them because it was their money. It was coming out of the skim, and then he would use his own money, and then they'd have to give him some of the skim money directly to reimburse him. But
go ahead. I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt you.
I want to bring up some other names of other politicians.
Well, the name that I always heard associated that was the Kansas City Mobs guy in Jeff City was
Fazino.
Yeah.
Right. And he probably was. We used to follow him around, we were following Cork around, actually, and we'd find Cork meeting with him in out-of-the-way places. Now, why is a state legislator going to meet Cork Savella in the back of a parking lot?
Right.
Get out and talk.
Donations.
Park their cars, get their donations, yeah. And you know, Alex ended up, he was suspected of several different things. He ended up actually taking a fall for corruption. So it wasn't a mob-related deal, but, I mean, he was taking money hand over fist, obviously. It's really a crazy kind of a case. He was going to sponsor some fireworks legislation, and the fireworks distributors did not want this legislation. If I remember right, it was fireworks legislation that he was going to affect. And so he went to them, and a friend of mine's dad was one of them, actually, and they paid him some money, and it came out. I think the Bureau had a wire on him somewhere at the time or had a wire on somebody, and they started looking. They went to these fireworks distributors and interviewed them, and they were not criminals, and they did not practice omerta, and they didn't really have to worry about Nick Savella, And Alex Fazino wasn't going to have somebody hit. So they testified, and he took a fall on that. So
you know, talking about, you know, did the average businessman or, you know, really have anything to fear from the Kansas City Mafia, would you say?
Yeah, not really, no. I mean, unless you put yourself in their bailiwick.
You start doing business with them
in some nefarious manner if you were trying to think if you took some money, if you let them invest in your business, if you got in trouble. Now they would like to. I had a guy who had he had a body shop, and he wanted to get in the used car business, and they kept approaching him to take some money to go in the used car business, and he knew what was going to happen. Once he got in that used car business, then they were going to put pressure on him. And what they would want him to do, and he told me, here's what they'll want me to do, is they'll want me to buy a bunch of cars, more than I can really afford, and then just get rid of them or have them stolen or something, and then claim it on insurance, and then not pay off they'll get a line of credit for me at the bank, and then not pay off the line of credit at the bank, and kind of more sophisticated kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But he told me how that was going to work. So mm-hmm. that would be a way you could get in trouble with the mafia.
Now on the local level, municipally, the River Key really had a lot of political activity, wouldn't you say, with the Kansas City mob?
Oh, yeah, that's the deal. When it first got started, there was liquor licenses were being granted, but not very many. And it was getting too high a concentration of liquor licenses without enough parking. And the West 12th Street group, there was a bunch of strip clubs between Wyandotte and Central on 12th Street, and they were going to tear them all down because of the Marriott Hotel. And the Bartle Hall had gone in by then, and they had a bunch of redevelopment money, and they all wanted to move to the Key. Well, this guy named Freddie Bonadonna did not want them to move to the Key. He knew that they were just going to bring the bad crowd, the wrong crowd down there, and it was not going to be a family-friendly place once they got there. So he had a good friend named Robert Hernandez, who was a city councilman who had unseated Sal Capra, by the way, and for that North End
district.
And so Hernandez started putting pressure on liquor control to not grant these liquor licenses for all these 12th Street clubs. Well, we always called them the 12th Street clubs. That's kind of everybody doesn't know what I mean, but there was these particular strip clubs from this area on 12th Street.
The Pink Pussycat
was one
of them.
The Pink Pussycat, the Park
Place.
Peyton Place, mm-hmm. Park Place.
But they're all pretty much just in a row, and they were all owned by various
mobsters.
And
at this point in time, also the Folly Theater is a pornographic
it still
peep
is,
show.
It was.
Really?
It still had live strippers even. I was a young policeman in 1971. I went in and saw a live stripper.
Off duty, and, of course.
No, I was on duty. I had to go check the building out, man. I was only 26 years old then.
Come on, Gary. You didn't want to see if they were breaking any fire codes.
Right. So, but this continued on, and so Capra was working behind the scenes to try to help them get those liquor licenses. They had a kind of semi-corrupt liquor agent inspector that was going around. This guy had, since I don't know if he's still alive or not, they never made a case on him, but I know he had a cleanup company that specialized in cleaning up bars after they closed down, and he was a liquor inspector for the city of Kansas City and responsible for doing background investigations. And so it's still not completely copacetic and 100% clean at this point in time, 1976.
They still had all that influence that
right, way. Right. And so what happened was there's a man named Y.H. Webb, who's a retired FBI agent who ran liquor control. So he was really working to stop these liquor licenses. So they had a politically appointed board of three people, I think. And so you could appeal if the agency denied your license, you could appeal to the board. And so they would appeal to the board, and every one of them started getting a liquor license. And pretty soon they all moved down there, and Hernandez couldn't do anything about it. And the rest is history.
Because
shall we
the folks that are on the board, they had their hooks in them.
Well, I don't know that for a fact, but they all of a sudden granted all those, this politically appointed board all of a sudden granted all these liquor licenses. So that was
something. And then they moved into the River Key.
Right. And they moved into the River Key, and the place became less family friendly. And there were some other problems that were going on at the time, and a building blew up, and nobody would ever come back down there until modern times. They just quit.
Quit. It's a complicated story, but it's a fascinating story of where you had the son of a mafioso who was actually trying to run a clean business down there, because Freddie Bonadonna was the son of David Bonadonna, who was and had been a member of the Camisano faction of the Kansas City family.
Right. You got Nick Savella's the titular head. You've got his brother, Carl Corky, who's kind of the co-boss or consigliere. You've got Tuffy DeLuna, who was the underboss, who took care of a lot of the day-to-day stuff on the street where you couldn't talk to Nick, but you could talk to Tuffy. And Tuffy would carry the message to Nick, and Nick would send messages back through Tuffy. He even sent him to negotiate with Chicago over some of the skim money. And, mm-hmm. and so, but then you had Willie Camisano, or Willie the Rat, and he had his own crew, and he had a crew of professional thieves, and they boosted and stole records and fenced them out through Tiger's record shops and
Tiger Cardarella.
Tiger Cardarella's record
Tiger's
store.
Records.
How many people here ever bought a record from Tiger's Records? If you're of a certain age, I did too. They were about half price, and never every one of them was boosted from some suburban record store. But that was Willie's thing, and it's more street kind of people, and he had a whole crew of them. David Bonadonna was one of those guys who then tried to influence his son Freddie to not resist these liquor licenses and these new clubs coming down there, and get his council person to quit resisting them, and Freddie wouldn't do it, and so they killed David, and Freddie owned this building down there, and the building blew up, and he collected a $100,000 insurance policy. It's a complicated story. It's like almost too big to tell. I tried to tell it in Gangland Wire, but it's a big story.
Now, the building blowing up, was that that was really just about collecting the insurance?
I believe there were three buildings that were blown up in the River Key. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, there was the one big building that Freddie and his brother and a guy named Frank Ancona owned.
Right.
And they collected money on that. And that was the big explosion. There was a smaller explosion at Joe Camisano's place, Cotton Eye Joe's, down at 3rd Street.
Okay.
And the other one was the warehouse, I believe. It was a joint that had
I think one was Pat O'Brien's.
Well, Pat O'Brien's and Judge Roy Beans.
And Judge Roy Beans.
They were the same building.
Okay.
That was the same incident.
Right.
Because they were two clubs.
Now, you mentioned
building.
Frank Ancona. Wasn't there a famous advertising?
Yeah.
What is it? Please be kind to Frank Ancona.
You know, I don't know. And he probably didn't have anything to do with it.
No, of course not.
But those three men owned that building, and there's a $100,000 insurance policy on it.
Yeah. So you know.
And they collected, I'm sure.
Why wouldn't they?
Of course, you know, it's never this simple. It's never that simple, because the two bars in there were way behind on their liquor bills. And so there are people out there that would say that the bar owners did it.
Not the building owners.
What?
Your computer went to
sleep. Let me ask something. Okay. Are we?
We're close here. We've got about 8 minutes before we're at the
top
of the hour.
Well, I'm just saying, are we going to take any questions, though?
Yeah, that was the other thing that we were going to do. I have a microphone here. If I want to, I can move it out somewhere where it might be convenient in the aisle way that if you have a question, we'll take some questions now. Hold on, let me move that.
Now, one thing I can tell you about people in Kansas City is everybody's got a mob story. And it's simply because, you know, the mafia was so pervasive in Kansas City for so many years that you couldn't help but be touched by it at some point along the way. I mean, if you lived here in Kansas City, really, it would be hard not to, you know, just bump into it.
Yeah, you bought a record from Tigers.
Yeah, you bought a record. I bought Yellow Brick Road for $2. From Tigers Records and Tapes.
We got any questions?
I'm not even from Kansas City. I moved here in like 2001, and then some years ago I started working at Chubby's on Broadway.
Oh my!
Which was at the time owned by the Labruzzos.
Yeah.
And they seemed like really upstanding people to me. They operated a good business, and I didn't know any of the other stuff that other people would always ask about. But Gary at one point asked me if I would ask somebody if they would corroborate on Gangland Wires. He was working on that documentary. Vince Pesciotta.
Vince Pesciotta, who took a fall for burning the Herbert House. And he said, all he wants is a snitch.
Yeah. Oh, he wants a snitch.
So it's still around. Anybody got a question?
You guys were talking about Freddie and David Bonadonna, and I don't know if you hit on it, and I was in the back, but about why the mob that was after Freddie and poor Freddie's and all the parking, why they chose to kill David Bonadonna instead of killing Freddie.
Yeah. Well,
because David was vulnerable. David was one of Willie's guys. So Willie could call, and Willie had told David, said, you got to do something about him. And David says, you know, you don't do anything to my son. If you do anything to my son, you got to go through me first. So if he goes and kills Freddie, or does anything to Freddie, he's got David hanging out there that's going to do something. So you might as well go ahead and get David first.
And then
Freddie
ain't
gonna do anything. Freddie was not a criminal. Freddie was not capable of doing this kind of stuff. His dad was.
And then when Freddie, after his dad got taken out, went into hiding.
He went into hiding, ended up testifying against Willie and Joe.
And Freddie, when Freddie was in the witness protection program for years and years, but isn't there a pretty interesting story about Freddie's demise as well?
Well, he committed suicide. Other than that, he had a restaurant down in Naples, Florida, as last I heard, and then he committed suicide. That's the only story I know about that.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Other questions from anybody here? Please.
There's a note here in the outline that we didn't quite cover, which was discuss the need to hide source of funds using the casinos to back Nevada politicians.
Sure, and that's what that video, that tape was all about, was they were trying to buy the sheriff, they were trying to buy the governor's election in 1978, and they donated money through the casino, through Carl Thomas and the Stardust Casino, to the... the Attorney General, Bob List, was running for governor, but they didn't give him any money because he was already after him as Attorney General. But a guy named Bob Rose was running for governor. They donated him a lot of money. And then the sheriff, there was a new sheriff in town named, the old sheriff was Ralph Lamb, and he was not going to be able to win. They knew that. And the new sheriff was a former Metro Police Sergeant, I believe. And now his name just escaped me, but he was running for sheriff and it looked like he was going to win. And so Carl Thomas donated all that money they were talking about to his campaign. Now they never had that new sheriff. They thought they did, but they have to keep that money filtered through the Teamsters. Nobody can take money by the 60s. Nobody's going to take money directly from a mob guy or actual mob organization or a business that you can easily check. Nobody's going to do that. But if you got the Teamsters or you got a casino or some other business that you can control from behind the scenes, way behind the scenes, nobody's name on any papers, then they can go donate money to politicians and stay clean and then come back around. And as Nick says, you say you got the guy, we got the guy. Now, they never had that guy, but they thought they might. They had a chance at him. Hmm.
Well, they were trying to, because I mean that was big business for them in Vegas.
Oh yeah,
on the skim.
Had the sheriff, sure.
And the reality was, as they were getting closed in on, not only was it occurring there in Vegas because of like the state attorney and the governor being after him, but on this side with the feds coming in after him because of the explosions that occurred in the River Market, and then they started wiretapping him, and
The
rest is really history.
Ma'am?
Here, let me turn that up.
Is it true that the Kansas side of Brush Creek was not paved because the Kansas people wouldn't cooperate with Pendergast? What's the story behind that?
I don't know, probably.
Well, it's interesting because Brush Creek really has the head of Brush Creek is really just not too far into Kansas. I mean, it's obviously a tributary, but it's just kind of a worthless creek, that's really interesting. The politics behind paving Brush Creek, because essentially they did it to put people to work. You know, the Pendergast machine had that philosophy of if they could have a machine that would do the work of 20 men, they hired 20 men. Because they wanted people to be employed. They didn't want to use the machinery for it. But I think it's pretty evident also, Tom Pendergast didn't really spend a lot of time and effort on the Kansas side. It was really all about Kansas City, Missouri politics and construction. And he had big arguments with J.C. Nichols when they were building the plaza. And at one time, he was overheard to be yelling at J.C. Nichols that, by God, if Nichols didn't do what he wanted him to do, he was going to build the Southwest Trafficway as a bridge over the plaza without any exits so that people wouldn't be able to access J.C. Nichols' beloved plaza. So
that's a good one.
And he had the cement to do it.
But really, if there's an interesting novel out now that I'll tell you people, it's by a UMKC literary professor, and it's called The King of Kings County. And it's
Whitney Terrell.
Yeah, Whitney Terrell. And in a fictional context, he tells the story about the development of I-35. And what basically it comes down to is that they encouraged white flight out of the East Side neighborhoods by providing mortgages to low-income ethnics, specifically black people. They made it available for black people to buy houses on the East Side so that they would leave the East Side, so that the white residents would white flight away from the East Side and buy what was being developed along the I-35 corridor over in Johnson County. And so it was a, and a lot of the mortgages that were being provided to the minorities were mafia sponsored money, is what it comes down to.
Interesting.
That was after World War II when they were developing the interstate system here in Kansas City. It's a fascinating read. It's in a fictional context, so it's somewhat little tough, you know, to figure out separate fact from fiction. But I think Mr. Terrell did do his research, and that's how he came to develop a storyline around the development of I-35, and that's why he had all that development go on over in Johnson County. It became a bedroom community. I mean, up until World War II, Johnson County was nothing. I remember when they kidnapped Nellie Don, they drove her way out into Kansas to 75th and Mission. There just wasn't that much going on over there until after World War II. And then when the I-35 corridor got put in, they bought up huge tracts of land and they started developing housing, and they needed people to move in over there. So they started mortgaging, selling mortgages at, very low prices to minorities on the East Side, get them in over there, so that caused the whites to move. So
okay, thanks, Terrence. We got to get out of here. Yep. We've got a whole new group moving in. So
yeah, they've got a 9 o'clock, poetry slam. So
we
got
to get out of here. Thanks a lot, folks.
Thank you, Terrence. Thank you, Gary. I'll play that little.